Hi, this is Faith Mitchell, President of Grantmakers in Health. I'd like to welcome you to the latest edition in GIH's podcast series. Our goal is to provide you with an insider's view of what's happening on the front lines of health by hearing from leaders in the field. I hope you enjoy these podcasts and find them insightful as you lead your philanthropic work.
So this is my great honor as a physician to introduce Dr. Jerome Adams, who serves as our nation's 20th Surgeon General. Dr. Adams was trained as an anesthesiologist. He was the Indiana State Health Commissioner. He did earn his master's in public health from my alma mater, UC Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley. And also he earned his medical degree at the Indiana State School of Medicine. So we are so honored to hear from Dr. Adams with regards to his perspective on where we are in this crisis that is affecting every one of our communities that we serve, and the perspective of what he brings, not only as our nation's chief health officer, but his perspective as a physician. So thank you, Dr. Adams.
Wow, thank you, everyone. Oh my gosh. I gotta tell you all, I was really, really excited to come and speak with you all. We spent the last week, last Thursday through Wednesday in Chicago. I was home for about 24 hours and then came back out here again because I said I absolutely wanted to come out here and address this group. You all are critically important. I'm gonna begin at the end because I know some folks have to leave, folks are running to catch planes, but I really want you to think about how you can lift up your philanthropy. Number one, how you can get upstream. Number two, how you can try to move policies and not just institute programs. And number three, how you can have an eye to sustainability in everything that you do. Because I think no matter what you care about, if you pay attention to those three things intentionally, you will be a lot happier. You'll see that you're having a lot bigger impact. I also want to tell you a quick story. It's a serious story. About a little over a year ago, my wife moved her and the kids to Washington, D.C. to be with me because I got sworn in September. They'd already started school, so they finished the first half of the school year, and over Christmas, they moved out. A few months after they moved out, my wife felt a lump in her groin. And the short version of a very long story is we went to get it checked out, and she got diagnosed with metastatic melanoma. We're blessed, knock on fake wood, that a year later, after surgery and a year of treatments, about a few weeks ago, she was declared cancer-free. Thank you. Thank you for that. I really appreciate that. It's been a trying time, and it's been definitely a learning experience for me and my family, especially having a 14, a 13, and a 9-year-old at home while I'm traveling all over the country and my wife is getting cancer treatments at Walter Reed. But I asked my wife, what would you want me to say to a group of grant makers? She said, tell them about Tracy and the bus. And Tracy is an individual who my wife met through her cancer treatments. And Tracy was a mom who had melanoma and actually had it removed, but then went on to start a foundation called Polka Dot Mamas that really helped to raise awareness about the ABCDEs of skin cancer and to promote skin cancer screenings. And last month was Melanoma Awareness Month, and they set a Guinness Book of World Record for doing the most cancer screenings in one day ever. They were able to do that because someone bought Tracy a bus, and they converted that bus into a mobile screening unit, and now they go around and provide cancer screenings. You know, while that's not a story that directly relates to a lot of the giving that you all do, I think it drives home the points of upstream policy and sustainability. I think one of the most important things you all can do is not think that you can solve the world's problems, but really to empower others to solve the world's problems. And so instead of trying to solve melanoma, they said, well, we've got a powerful advocate out there. Let's give her the tools that she needs to go out there and set a Guinness Book of World Records for cancer screening. When you talk about sustainability, when I think through this story, there's pros and cons to this story. Tracy comes from a pretty well-to-do family. Her husband's a physician, and so they bought her the bus, and she was able to actually sustain that bus and continue to do screenings. But I've been to far too many communities across America where philanthropy comes in, they buy something new and flashy, and then there's no plan for maintaining it, and the community doesn't have the money to maintain it, and that bus does no good if it breaks down in 6 weeks, and no one knows how to fix it or has the money to be able to fix it. So I think that was an important point. I think looking at policy and getting upstream, I think it's also important because they were looking not just to raise money for cancer awareness, but they also were looking to raise awareness about secondary and primary prevention. The final point that I'd make is, as much as I'm so proud of my wife and Tracy and so happy that they had good people around to treat their melanoma, I'd much rather if there was a policy in place 30 years ago that didn't allow them to get into tanning beds as teenagers. We wouldn't have a need to go out and buy a bus so that we could help screen people for the melanoma that they never should have had in the first place. And so I think it really illustrates the points of getting upstream, looking at sustainability, and policy changes. Now I'm going to back up for a little bit because I realize even in medical crowds that a lot of folks don't know what the Surgeon General is or does. First of all, I'm not the Attorney General. We're going to take some Q&A at the end, and if you have questions for the Attorney General, I will not be answering them. Second, to the untrained eye, and I know many of you all are heading out to the airport, I may appear to be an airline pilot. And they tried to check me into the hotel as a Spirit Airlines pilot last night. If you see me getting into the cockpit of your plane, go the other way. Find a different plane. And then finally, I'm neither a surgeon nor a general. I'm actually an anesthesiologist, and I still practice occasionally at Walter Reed Hospital because I feel it's important to still have that clinical input and be involved and hear feedback from folks who are doing it. And I'm Vice Admiral in the United States Public Health Service Commission Corps, which is why I get to wear this uniform. The Commission Corps is 6,500 uniformed officers whose mission is protect, promote, and advance the health and safety of our nation. But the most visible role of the Surgeon General is to communicate the science around health to the American people. And in that role, I'm focused on promoting health, preventing disease, and leading with the science. And during my tenure, there are three main areas that are central to all my efforts. One of my big efforts is making the connection between community health and economic prosperity, helping folks understand that communities that invest in health see not just health for individuals and not just health for health's sake, but they see improvements in job growth and wage growth. They see the entire community benefit. I'm putting out a report on that because you know what folks don't vote on? They don't vote on health. And that's not my opinion. If you look at Gallup polls, the number one issue people vote on is jobs and the economy, and health rarely ranks up there as a top priority. Number two, I'm raising awareness of the link between our nation's health and its national security. Here's a tweetable stat for you. 7 out of 10 of our 18 to 24-year-olds are ineligible for military service in this country right now. 7 out of 10, because they can't pass the physical, can't meet the educational requirements, or have a criminal background record. In short, because they come from unhealthy communities. And guess what the number two issue people vote on is across the country on a very consistent basis? It's safety and security. And we go to Congress, we go to state houses, and we beg for nickels and dimes in the name of health. The Department of Defense says, we need a new tank or we need a new plane. And they say, how much do you need? And hand them a blank check. So when you look back at sustainability again, the more that we can help folks understand that the things that you're engaging in, the innovations that you're funding, ultimately lead not just to healthier individuals, but to a safer, more secure, and more prosperous country, the more we'll be able to get a plan for sustainability, the more we'll be able to get that policy change that we know is critical. Those were the two things I planned to focus on, and I intentionally picked them as cross-cutting initiatives, because one of the biggest challenges of being Surgeon General is every day there's 5 to 10 people who come in my office and want me to make their top priority my top priority, and there's only one of me to go around. But I think, again, if you show folks whatever you care about that it leads to safer and more prosperous communities, then you'll have much better success. In the words of the great philosopher Mike Tyson, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. The punch in the mouth that we're dealing with right now is the opioid epidemic. And I think it's both a terrible tragedy, but also a tremendous opportunity. Why do I say it's an opportunity? Because I can go to any community in America right now and have a packed house to talk about the opioid epidemic. And if we use that opportunity to then talk about the upstream factors that lead to substance misuse, the untreated mental health issues, the lack of resilience and wellness in communities, then we'll see not just that we resolve the opioid epidemic, but we'll see that it will help us have lower infant mortality rates. We'll have lower cancer rates. We'll have less smoking. We'll have improvements in all the areas that we care about. My guiding principle across this and all of my priorities is better health through better partnerships. Because when the solutions are complex, and especially when they're controversial, and what isn't controversial nowadays, we cannot afford to operate in silos. We must remember that everyone can contribute to the solution. And so when you're sitting down having your discussions about how you can improve health in communities, you need to bring people and organizations to the table that might not ordinarily come there, that you may not have thought of before. We've got to look to businesses. We've got to look to academia. How often are you inviting the principals to the table, the college professors? We've got to look to the military. When's the last time you've invited the local National Guard or Reserve or your local military base to come and sit at your table when you're talking about health? Because again, it matters to them. They're worried about the fact that they can't keep our country safe. When's the last time you brought faith leaders to the table? They're doing this work on the community level. When's the last time you brought public safety? You invited a sheriff to come sit down at your table. You know, how are you going to solve the opioid epidemic if you don't reach people where they are? Unfortunately, the number one mental health providers in our country right now, de facto, are our prisons and jails. So we need to make sure they're at the table when we're having these discussions. And philanthropy has to have a seat at the table also. So I want to quickly go over some things that we're doing to respond to the opioid epidemic. Number one, we're working to prevent addiction before it starts. Remember I said we have to get upstream. It's important that we deal with the entire spectrum of the opioid epidemic, but we've got to turn off the spigot. So we're working with health professionals to improve safe prescribing practices and minimize diversion by encouraging people to utilize the CDC guidelines for prescribing opioids for pain. We're trying to help people understand the benefits of alternatives to opioids. This is critical. This is critical. We can't pat ourselves on the back for decreasing opioid prescribing if we don't also measure whether or not we're substituting in something else, because 62% of people who misuse opioids say they're misusing them to treat pain. You're just going to keep playing whack-a-mole if we don't deal with that underlying epidemic of chronic pain. And we're also helping people understand how to safely store and dispose of prescription medications. 80% of heroin users say they got started with a prescription opiate, theirs or someone else's. Critical that we understand that, that we understand that the first drug dealer for most folks isn't some bad guy out on the streets peddling drugs. It's all of you. It's us. It's anyone who right now has unused opioids in their medicine cabinet. Because those opioids are getting diverted to other places. And I know, statistically speaking, there are several of you in this room right now who have unused opioids sitting in your medicine cabinets. Unfortunately, there are people who come in your houses who rifle through those cabinets. There's nieces, there's nephews, there's sons, there's daughters, there's babysitters, there's house cleaners, maintenance workers who come through and will take those opioids, and they may end up being someone's first taste, their pathway down the road of addiction. Number two, my office is working to educate the public about the severity of the epidemic and to destigmatize addiction. And some of you have heard me share my story about my baby brother, Philip. Philip had unrecognized, untreated mental health issues that he self-medicated with alcohol, with tobacco, with marijuana. And I hope we have a conversation about marijuana day. Then he went to a party and someone gave him a pill. Maybe a pill that came from one of your medicine cabinets. And that rapidly led to heroin addiction. He stole $200 from a vacated property to support his habit and got a 10-year prison sentence. I share his story for two reasons. Number one is a very practical reason. It costs about $150 to $200 a day to incarcerate someone. Times 10 years, well, let's say times 5 years, even if he only served half his prison sentence, means you all as taxpayers, either directly or through your organizations, are going to pay upwards of $500,000 to incarcerate him. Now, you want to talk about sustainability. Wouldn't you rather have that $500,000 to build sustainability into some of your programs that you're working on in the community? Instead of $500,000 on him, why don't we spend $5,000 on a court diversion program? Why don't we spend $500 on making mental health services available to him? Why don't we spend $50 on a community resilience program, on a YMCA program, on an after-school program, so he has an option other than to spend time with people who are going to send him down the wrong pathway? The other reason I share his story is, again, because I think one of the biggest killers out there is stigma. We know addiction is a disease and not a moral failing, and we know that it can happen to any family, but I want folks to understand that if it could happen to the family of the Surgeon General of the United States, and my parents raised a Surgeon General, they must have done something right, that it can happen to anybody. And we need you all to help us lower stigma about the disease of addiction. We need you to help us spread the word that, as with any other disease, we have evidence-based treatments and that we know recovery is possible. Final thing my office is doing is putting naloxone in the hands of first responders and community members, because we should always strive to prevent death. And one way to do that is to be prepared with naloxone in the event of an opioid overdose. I want to ask you guys a question, speaking of naloxone. Raise your hand if you know CPR. Look around the room. Wow, that's impressive. Lots of folks know CPR. Raise your hand if you carry naloxone everywhere you go. Now look around the room. Anyone notice a difference? Statistically speaking, especially in the era we're in right now, and especially where we are right now, it is more likely that someone's going to come in that door and say someone's overdosing in the bathroom down the hall than what it is that someone's going to come in that room and say, we need you to come perform CPR. And who would be equipped to respond in one scenario versus the other? Last year, I put out the first Surgeon General's advisory in 13 years, advising folks to understand what naloxone is and to be willing to carry it. Because there's a person dying of an opioid overdose every 11 minutes in this country, and most of them are dying at home. Most of them are dying in a bathroom, in a bedroom, in a garage. An anoxic brain injury occurs in 4 to 6 minutes. So until we invent an ambulance that can arrive to your door in 4 to 6 minutes, we need more people to be willing to carry naloxone. So I want you to see these two take-home versions of naloxone. One is the intranasal version, and the other is Evzio, the injectable version. And the injectable version talks to you. Really easy to use. The other one is the intranasal version. You just put it in the nostril, and you press. That's how easy it is to save a life. Easier than your CPR course that many of you took, right? We need more of you all to walk the talk, to carry naloxone so you can be prepared to respond, but also so that you can talk to other folks about the importance of carrying naloxone. And I want to dig a little bit deeper into my Community Health and Economic Prosperity Initiative, because it was inspired by the upstream social determinants of health, the community determinants of health, and our need to lean more into them. Again, CHEP is the concept that community health and economic prosperity are inextricably linked. When community health is poor, so is community prosperity, and vice versa. Anyone hear about this little company called Amazon? Little startup? The big news over the last year was where they put their second headquarters. They put it in Crystal City, Virginia. Well, if you look at U.S. News and World Report's list of 500 healthiest cities in the entire United States, 4 of those cities surround Crystal City, Virginia. That is not a coincidence. We know that healthier communities are able to attract a healthier workforce, and workforce is actually the metric that organizations are looking at. I've talked to CEOs, I've talked to business schools. They actually don't move specifically to healthier communities, but they move to communities where there is a ready and educated, a young, a healthy workforce. So critical that we lean into that. We know that workers with chronic pain, looking at the bridge between opioid misuse and my CHEP initiative, account for between $11 and $13 billion in lost productivity annually. So if you're a company, you're going to move to a community where there's high amounts of chronic pain, where many people are checked out of the workforce. There's 7 million unfilled jobs in this country right now, only 5 million people looking for work. We're in an economic boom that is at risk of stalling because we don't have enough workers. The good news, and remember I said the opioid epidemic is an opportunity, is now people are looking at folks with criminal records, people with a history of substance use disorder, people who have that scarlet letter on them, and trying to figure out how can we change the way that we look at them and reintegrate them back into the workforce. And that's a great place for you all to think about spending some of your philanthropic money. How can we reintegrate some of these folks who we've pushed out of the workforce and out of life back in to the labor market? I don't want you all to think that I point fingers at other folks without sharing my own stories. I worked at an occupational health clinic when I was in residency. And We took care of people from companies, and we were told, get them back to work. I handed out my fair share of opioids to folks with acute and chronic pain. And we now know that inevitably many of these folks become addicted to these substances and become not just a problem for themselves and their families, but become a problem for the companies that they work for. The cost of the opioid crisis has become so well established that the nonprofit Shatterproof made a calculator where businesses can estimate how much money they've lost due to the epidemic. And total cost, as modeled by the Council of Economic Advisors, may be as high as even $500 million. And I mention that again because when you're trying to engage with organizations as partners, part of your role is to help them understand how much health actually costs them and the poor health of communities actually costs them and why they need to lean into it. So how do we go about recouping the costs lost from poor health? As a nation, we already know we spend way more on healthcare than any other country. You all know this, but get very, very poor outcomes. Why is it that we spend so much and get so little? You've been talking about this all week long, but it's important that you hear me say this, especially as we wrap up. Health care is a very small part of health. 80 to 85% of health is driven by factors that have little to nothing to do with health care, at least as it's currently constructed. It has to do more with factors that are in our communities, environment, behaviors, employment, education, social support. About 10% of health is driven by the things we do within the clinic walls and within the hospital. So much more of it is driven by our physical environment, our social and economic factors such as education, employment, income, community safety, family and social supports we wrap around folks. Those are the consequences of and causes of our nation's health not being as good as it could be, that insane amount of spending. But it's because we're focusing 90% of our resources on 10% of the problem. What's interesting is when you compare us to countries like Sweden, like Canada, like the UK, we actually spend about the same on health in reality as they do. It's just that they're spending it on the full spectrum of health, and we're spending it on 10% of what actually contributes to health. I want to give you some good news. You now have both a Republican and a Democratic presidential administration that have acknowledged the need to shift from fee-for-service payment for health care to outcomes-based systems. This is an opportunity for each and every one of you all because these healthcare systems out there are looking for groups that can help them convene individuals who can lean into these social determinants of health. Critically important. We just approved the largest Medicaid waiver ever for North Carolina, $650 million to lean into the social determinants of health. Indiana, my home state, just started up their Healthy Opportunities Office to figure out how they can assess people for social needs and then meet their social needs. And I was just talking with Winston earlier about Kaiser Permanente's efforts to do the same thing. So this is where healthcare is going. I challenge you all to figure out where you fit into that equation and how you can help us transition from a fee-for-service world, from a world where we focus on 10% of the problem, to a world that is committed to improving better outcomes by focusing on the whole problem. I want to save time for some questions, so I want to start to wrap it up with a few calls to action. What can you all do to help us get to where we need to be? You have unique opportunities to leverage your influence and resources to forge those stronger partnerships, to really achieve better health through better partnerships that effectively promote the health, the safety, the security, the economic prosperity of your communities. So don't forget about those partners. Include those businesses, those civic leaders, those law enforcement folks, the military and faith-based leaders. Because we'll only achieve our mutual goals when we sit at the table together. When we invite those folks to our table and when we actually have the humility to go to their table and sit down and listen to them. One of the other problems with the philanthropic community, and I love you guys, we get a great idea and then we try to ram it down the community's throat. Well, if we don't sit down at their table and show them that we care about their needs, then we're not going to achieve our goals. There's a saying, nothing about us without us. We need to make sure the community is involved. And it may not end up looking like we wanted it to look like or like we thought it was going to look like in the first place. But you can have the best diabetes prevention program, the best substance misuse program in the world. And if a person doesn't have a house, a bed, a pillow to lay their head on at night, they're not going to be fully engaged in your program and it's going to fail. When looking at investment and donation portfolios, I encourage you to look past the healthcare encounter and the clinical settings. All those are critically important. I am so glad folks raised money for melanoma treatment and research so that when my wife got her melanoma, she could receive the care that she needed, she could get fished out of the stream. But again, I don't want anyone else to have to go through what my family went through over the last year. And I want to make sure while we're treating people who fall into the stream that we're looking upstream and making sure we are really focusing on efforts that show us measurable and positive health outcomes for the health of the community. Hold your recipients accountable for making sure they're looking upstream and that they're engaging in those social determinants of health and that they're bringing in new partners to the table. Support investments in products that uplift good health and not just health care. And even though some folks in this room are on the philanthropic side, the fact is that investments like these are not only important on both the moral and the social side, we need to show folks that there's a value in investing in them that accrues to the entire community. We need to make the case from here, and many of you all are here because your mission lies in the heart, but we need to show more people that your mission also makes good fiscal and economic sense, and that it also helps folks have more money to take home in the end. About one out of every $5 that you all make, that people in our communities make, that organizations generate right now in our economy, now goes to pay for healthcare. Even for the folks out there who don't care about the poor health of our community, that's money that's not going to education. That's money that's not going to all the other things that they might care about, so everyone needs to care about overall health. I want to finish by calling on you all to think about and be intentional about a few things. First, I want you to be intentional and persistent about pursuing equity. We often give ourselves a pat on the back for driving the averages down, but we don't realize that many of the programs that we support and put in place are helping the folks who least need the help and are forgetting about the folks who most need the help. Why? Because we went after the low-hanging fruit. And yes, you want to get some easy, quick wins, but far too often, we actually see the averages go down, but see the disparities widen. So think about and be persistent about pursuing equity and embedding it into everything that you do. How does this relate specifically to you all? Well, I had a lot of money pass through my organization when I ran the State Department of Health in Indiana. I'd say, what do you need? People would say, we need more money. And sometimes I'd find them some money. I'd say, we need more manpower. Sometimes we'd find them more manpower. Then I'd check back in and nothing would have changed. Well, why? Because sometimes people need help before they can receive your help. And that's a challenge that we have in many cases. We need to build up the capacity within some of these communities and some of these organizations so that they can appropriately receive your help. You can't bring in a group of folks and have them help you out if you've got one person doing the job before and there's no one to supervise them or tell them where to sit or coordinate their activities. In many cases, we find a lot of these groups sitting on money that we gave them long afterwards because we didn't intentionally build up that capacity and help them develop a plan for how they were going to appropriately receive that money, distribute that money, and be accountable for that money. Look into many of the new programs that are out there, CDFIs, opportunity zones. Think about how you can bridge what you're doing, use your money as a spark, and then connect people with some of these programs that will provide a little bit of additional sustainability in your community. I want to finish by saying it's important that we look upstream, but don't forget about some of the gaps that exist downstream. And as someone who raised up naloxone, there are still a lot of gaps out there. And if you're looking for a place to spend money downstream, we know that the communities that have been able to turn around the opioid overdose rates are really the ones that have saturated their communities with naloxone. Final point I want to make to you, if you're looking for target areas where you really should invest your resources, every nonprofit hospital, and many of you all know this, has to do a community needs assessment. When you go around and you talk to CEOs of hospitals, one of the things they're most consistently shocked by is they go to the community and say, well, what's your biggest health need? And the answer that they get is housing. And they say, no, what's your biggest health need? And the people say, I told you, it's housing. Leaning into housing, it's a critical gap, and we don't have good systems on a state, a local, or a federal level to really fill those gaps. We're trying to as quickly as we can, but figuring out how you can get people into affordable, sustainable, safe housing is critically important. One of my predecessors, Jocelyn Elders, said if you want to improve the health of people, improve their education. Really thinking about after-school programs, which those in the educational community know are where a lot of the problems occur. Kids come home to a house without parents, without something to do, and they fall into bad habits. They end up misusing substances, getting pregnant at young ages, hanging with the wrong crowd, being exposed to traumatic experiences. We also know that the biggest fallback for folks is not during the school year in between bad schools. It's actually in the summertime. We invest so much effort in trying to close the gap during the school year, but if we just got everyone into a good summertime program, then we would do more to close the gaps in educational achievement across communities than what we would by focusing on all the disparities that occur between schools across the nation during the school year. And that's not to say that we shouldn't still tackle those disparities, but when you're thinking about where you can lean into areas that will improve health, think about the root causes of poor health. Think about poor educational attainment. Think about lack of resilience and wellness in communities that's caused by kids not having something to do and not having a positive role model. Think about the fact that no one's going to be healthy or compliant with anything you're doing if they don't have a bed to lay their head on. With that, I want to close and open it up for questions. I want to thank you all for being here. I want to thank you for what you all do each and every day. You all play a valuable role. Think upstream. Think about policy changes. Think about sustainability. And know that the Surgeon General of the United States stands with you to help you get to a place where, again, we can say that we're spending more of our money on health and not just health care, and we can be proud of the results that we're getting. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.